Boker Tov, Boker Tov. This morning we have a dedication of the Shi'ur. It's sponsored by Muhammad Ben David, Naomi Lifshitz, and Carol Kimchi and families, in loving memory of their parents, Al and Evelyn Sturman, Leilui Nishmat Chava Chaya Bat Matatyahu, which the Yahrzeit was on Kavzayin Shvat, and Avraham Yitzhak Ben Aaron Yosef Halevi, on Kavtet Shvat. I had the pleasure of knowing the Sturmans, parents of our good friends, Naomi Lifshitz, who's a regular at the Shir. And I do remember them fondly. They were Ohavei Torah and Mokirei Tzion. And well, it was always a pleasure to be around. This week, we're going to deal with the next son-in-law, the other son-in-law, the older son-in-law of our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, Rav Professor Yitzchak, or sometimes known as Isidore Twersky, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha. We dealt with the Rav, we dealt with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, we dealt with Rav Amital, we dealt with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, we dealt with many, many personalities since we began this series. And in the course of the book that was published by Yeshiva University on 10 personalities who've impacted on modern orthodoxy and Western thought, Rav Twersky was included. Now, the truth of the matter is that, of course, Rav Twersky was a well-known personality in the academic world of Jewish studies, extremely well-known. He was probably one of the most outstanding Rambam experts of the generation. In Hebrew, we call them Rambamistim, a great Rambam expert. He also was well known in the Boston area, which was his local place. He was known in the Yeshiva University world as well. I'm not sure that he impacted from his Torah point of view on United States Jewry, and it certainly didn't make it all the way to Eretz Yisrael, but it may have a chance now, because of two books that were published just last year, and I want to make reference to them. Those of you who read the Torah tidbits of Parshat Shoftim, this came out on the 2nd of Elul of just a half a year ago, the weekend of August 22nd, holding it up right here. This particular edition carried a book review that I myself wrote for the two books that were published within the last year, and I entitled the review Two Luminaries in One Giant, and I'm referring to the following two books, and we're going to make reference to them. One is a giant-sized book that was put out by a chaver of mine, Rav Professor Carmi Horowitz. The book is an anthology of 31 articles that Rav Professor Twersky wrote throughout his illustrious academic career as the senior professor of medieval Jewish history and thought at Harvard University. The Sefer is called Kima'ayan HaMidgaber. It's all in Hebrew. It takes articles that Rabbi Twersky wrote in Hebrew, and those that were written in English, they were translated into Hebrew. So this is a very much an Israeli contribution to the world of Rabbi Twersky's scholarship, which was absolutely amazing. And the second book was put out, came out almost at the very same time by another chaver, Rav David Shapiro, who served for many years as the principal of the Maimonides School in Boston under the helm of the Rav. And it's called Torah of the Mind, Torah of the Heart, Divrei Torah of the Tolna Rebbe. Here you have a picture of Rav Twersky, Rav Yitzchak Isidore Twersky. And what's interesting, more than just interesting, is that we're dealing with a person who, as I called it, two luminaries in one giant. The Rabbi Twersky, who grew up in Boston, son of a Hasidish Rebbe who migrated from the United States, from the Ukraine, Rabbi Meshulam David Twersky, who was known as the Tolna Rebbe, 1925, opened up a shtiebel in 1925 in Boston. Any of you who have had any knowledge of the history of Boston in the mid-20s, it was a complete desert of Jewish studies, understanding, practice, and so on. Mamash, clearly. And it's interesting that just a few years later, 1932, when our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik, who was then 29 years old, emigrates to the United States, he also comes to Boston and sets up, and he gets involved in first as a shul rabbi, and then later founding the educational institutions, first and foremost, the Maimonides School, which exists till this very, very day. The Tolna ran a shtiebel, did what many local Hasidic rebbes would do, would have Shabbos afternoon tish and give the Divrei Torah, and provide the spiritual warmth that people who are interested in that type of brand of Judaism. So Rabbi Tversky himself grew up in that environment where there were no yeshivas. He went to public school. He went to some private school. He ends up in Harvard University as a student and makes it and works his way up the ranks to becoming one of the most senior professors in Harvard University, and is extremely active academically. He had spent some time in Israel at the Hebrew University. He befriended many of the great scholars of Jewish studies of the past two generations, and he was well equipped with his academic training. Plus, he had the great fortune of marrying into the Soloveitchik family, because he married the eldest daughter of the Rav, Atara, and he then became a one-on-one student by the Rav in Boston. Rabbi Tversky never studied in yeshiva, and he didn't learn by the Rav at YU. He studied by the Rav at home in Boston for many, 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 many years. And he was developed as an outstanding Talmud Chacham, and parallel to that, an outstanding scholar. And what's interesting is that he was able to basically live not two distinct lives, but was able to bring into his academic life something of the spirituality of being part of the Tolna dynasty, Hasidic dynasty. And there was something about Rav Tversky in the context of the Tolna shtiebel in Boston, where you could hear that this was a professor of Harvard who was doing the talking in terms of his awareness of sources and people. And to this extent, I wrote that I entitled this essay called Two Luminaries in One Giant, because he really was great in both of these areas. But it was pretty clear that in each of the areas, you could sense the hovering above of the other persona in Rabbi Tversky. The one who develops this thought, this theme, very, very nicely is Professor Carmi Horowitz. For in the book that I've been referring to several times over from Yeshiva University, you can see the picture of Rabbi Tversky on the bottom of this page, Torah and Western Thought, the article was written by Rabbi Carmi Horowitz as well, and he also in his book Kimayana Mitgaber re-emphasizes the point that even as a pure academician, you see that he is busy dealing with issues of spirituality. He's showing that the works of the great medieval giants like the Rambam and others not only spoke of dry halakha, but through the words you can measure, engage the spirituality levels that the Rambam and others were trying to inculcate by the performance of halakha. You see almost a Hasidic take in this type of academic approach. So too, when Rav Tversky, who succeeded his father as the Tolna Rebbe, his father passed away in 1972, and Rav Tversky functioned without a title for many years until the early 1980s, where he was persuaded by people. He was a great, very humble person, but nevertheless, he was persuaded by people to assume the title, the Tolna Rebbe. So here you have a man who's now in the 80s and the 90s, he's the Tolna Rebbe, and he's also a professor at Harvard University. I had asked once Rabbi Mital, Zichrono Lebracha, I said, such a fusion of such a great individual in two different areas of Hasidic life and academic life in one person, I asked Rav Amital, do you think here in Israel we could even possibly come close to producing such a synthesized personality? And Rav Amital responded that he doesn't think that in the United States today the Jewish community is capable of putting forth such a composite in one person of being a Hasidic great leader and an academician. I doubt it. If you have any of the people in Jewish studies today, great people in Jewish studies today in the United States, who would ever dream about considering being a Hasidic Rebbe, and I doubt if any Hasidic Rebbe today in America would ever think that his place should be in the academia, not just getting a college degree, but going for the distance of becoming a senior professor in a particular subject of Jewish studies. It's not that you're a professor of economics or a professor of physics or something else. This became a very, very touchy issue because our Rebbe Rav Soloveitchik was not a big, put it mildly, not a big fan of to make the Jewish studies into an academic endeavor, but rather, you know, to keep it within the framework of Beit Midrash and so on. And yet Rabbi Twersky felt comfortable using the platform of his academic world to promote Torah ideas. As a matter of fact, in class at Harvard, someone asked him once, because they knew how dedicated he was to the mitzvah of Talmud Torah, and they asked him, don't you think that all this history that you're teaching now and what we're doing in these seminars, academic seminars, is not in the realm of Beitel Torah? You're not wasting Torah study time? And Rabbi Twersky responded by saying, everything we do in this seminar is Talmud Torah. Now that it takes a lot of guts to make that kind of a comment. That indeed you have an individual who very much saw himself in the realm of academia, but also bringing to the table Torah values and spirituality that went along with it. So if anybody's interested in reading Rabbi Twersky's book from Carmi Horowitz, you're going to need a lot of time. It's a heavy book physically, 700 pages, and you have to be academically inclined for this kind of material. I personally enjoyed several of the articles. One was the hesped that Rabbi Twersky gave for his father-in-law, the Rav, after the Rav passed away in 1993. There also are some articles here. There are some articles that very much were close to my heart. The Rambam as a personality throughout the ages, and so on. So I found some very good subject matter to read in this book. But the second book that came out is much more of a popular nature. In order to introduce it, I'm just going to repeat something I wrote in the book review as an introduction to the book review. I recall back as a student in Yeshivat Har Etzion in 1972, so Rav Lichtenstein, we had two Rosh Yeshivas. We talked about Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Amital. So Rav Lichtenstein got up and gave a talk, a sicha. And he was very, very upset about those who thought that to become a serious Talmud Chacham, there are shortcut methods, that you can just have blurbs and sound bites, using our modern expression. And by having such thoughts, you could develop into a Talmud Chacham. Rav Lichtenstein was using military language, and you have to realize the boys in Yeshivat Har Etzion were also soldiers, so this made sense. He said, "Tzarich lichbosh et ha-sugya." You have to conquer the sugya. You have to see it from all sides. You have to have a strategy of how you're going to make your move. And what you're going to use, which weapons, that is to say, you can use the Rambam and the Ramban or Ritva, which are the weapons are you going to use to bring about a total understanding of the sugya, the subject matter in the Gemara. And you have to just somehow or another catch it from all sides. And that's how you become a Ben Torah. And it takes a tremendous amount of time and effort, and there's no shortcuts here. And then he used the phrase, he says, "Lo konim Torah im Vertlach." You cannot acquire Torah with these one line, a vertlach is from the word vort. Vort means a word. Vertlach means a few words. So, you know, a few words is what you say when somebody asks you at Sudash Lishit, you want to say a few words. So I remember there was a rabbi in America who once said, we've got up for Shabbos Russia, and he said, before I start speaking, I want to say a few words. And then everybody knew they were in big trouble because the introduction, you want to say a few words. A par verta, as they say in Yiddish. So that's called vertlach. Vertlach, you hear it, you know, this Kotzke Rebbe said this, and there's a little thought here and a little thought there, and a thought. In Yiddish, it's called a gedank. These are vertlach. Rav Aaron said, lo konim Torah vertlach. You cannot acquire Torah by just accumulating all of these vertlach. So Rav Mital was sitting right there in the Beit Midrash, and he looked up and he said, nachon, nachon, lo konim Torah im vertlach. You don't acquire Torah with vertlach. Aval kach mochrim Torah. That's how you market Torah. And it was very telling. And everybody sat there like a giggle that they had the chutzpah to say that. He said it to Rav Lichtenstein right at the shir. He says, "B'kach mochrim Torah." How do you sell Torah? You think selling Torah, marketing it to the general population, is by standing there and giving three-hour lectures and shiurim, in-depth analysis and so on? You're not going to have a crowd. You're not going to have a crowd. And if I could just reflect upon yesterday's Parshat HaShavua, Moshe Rabbeinu thought he was going to teach the entire nation. And Yitro, his father-in-law, says, Moshe, you're going to lose the crowd. You got to break it down to small groups and have the smaller groups teach differently. You can't do it like that. They're not going to absorb it. And Rav Mital was a master of delivering the punch in a very, very, very short time. I remember once, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, who we adored as a master of a Baal Sicha, but you know, sometimes he would speak so long on a Leil Rosh Hashanah before Ma'ariv, he spoke an hour and a half. Okay, he had a lot to say, but it was an expanded and using all kinds of flowery language and so on. After the talk, Rav Mital passed me by in the aisle, and he passed me on the shoulder, and he says, "Arela yechotu lagid et hakol ve'eser dakot." He says, you could have said everything in 10 minutes. I said, you're right. It just wouldn't have come out like that. But the point is that sometimes you can encapsulate a theme and shrink it to basic component parts, and that's all the crowd can take. So if you're talking about a yeshiva, where you're dealing with cultivating Talmid Chachamim and so on, they should be able to handle a talk of an hour and a half with Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. But I remember when I invited Rav Aaron Lichtenstein to my neighborhood in Astoria, Queens, to represent Yeshiva Har Etzion. We did a fundraising breakfast for the yeshiva the year after I came back from the yeshiva. And I said, Rebbe, do me a favor, not more than 20 minutes. I had to ask him that. Do me a favor, not more than 20 minutes. All right, so he spoke a half an hour, but that was good. Had I not said something, he may have lost himself. And Rav Mital, he always knew exactly what the crowd needed. You teach Torah with vertlach. And I use this as an entree to Rabbi Twersky, because in Harvard, Rabbi Twersky wanted that you should conquer the sugya. You want to do something about a project, an academic project in one of the greats of the Middle Ages, you have to read everything that was ever written about that individual. You have to attack it from all sides. You have to be thorough. Anybody that ever did a doctorate for Rabbi Twersky knew that it was at least a 10-year project, because he was such a perfectionist and wouldn't let something go through. Yet, the same Rabbi Twersky, as a Hasidic Rebbe at the Tolna Beis Medrash Shtibel in Boston, would give talks for Sudash Lishit, for Shalosh Chodesh. And there, his crowd were not Harvard students, although you had a handful. Rabbi David Shapiro and Rabbi Carmi Horowitz would attend it, but it was by and large designed for Balabatim. And there, Rabbi Twersky, because of time constraints for Sudash Lishit, anyway, you cannot be, you know, terribly verbose. You have to bring it to some type of a halt when it comes to the end of Shabbos. But nevertheless, the nature of these talks were very, very concise talks. And what Rabbi Shapiro did was, every Motzei Shabbat, wrote down everything he heard from his Rebbe, Rabbi Twersky. everything. He wrote it down and he tried to get it word for word as much as humanly possible for a human being to remember the sources for sure. Yes, correct. And he double checked it with other people and so on. But even the phrases, he just wanted to make sure that when you're reading the book, Torah of the Mind, Torah of the Heart, you're hearing Rabbi Tversky at the time. And you can see that in these particular sections, he tries to develop a specific idea that is going to go over very well with the crowd. And in that respect, that's how he is spreading his Torah. And the great hope is that with Sfarim that were published here in Yerushalayim, like Torah of the Mind, Torah of the Heart, and this is just on Breishit and Shmot, and I'm aware of the fact that on the rest of the Torah, it's already in preparation. When this goes public and is spread and more people are going to be reading it, they're going to realize and appreciate the greatness of Rabbi Tversky as a teacher of Torah. In the academic world, he's already there. He's already a superstar in every sense of the word. That does not have any question. So therefore, because we're not dealing with academics per se, although I will say, just beyond the book that came out this year, Kimayana Mitgaber, the two main works of Rabbi Tversky were the halachic monograph of the Ravid, Rabbi Avraham ben David, the from Pau Square, that is southern France, Provence, late 12th century, he dies in 1198, 12th century personality, who already received from Egypt an early text of the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, and he already comments, and he has what to say, and he has critical comments. He's known as the Baal HaSagot, the one who wrote critical comments on the Rambam. He's a towering personality to write it, and this was the first attempt to write a monograph on one of the great Rishonim, and this was really Rabbi Tversky's doctoral dissertation at Harvard, which then became a book in 1962, but his greatest work was the introduction to the code of Mishneh Torah of Maimonides, of the Rambam, and it's also a 500-600 page work where he divides the entire understanding of the Mishneh Torah into various categories in terms of form, categories, language, law, and philosophy, and it's just it's this unbelievable testimony to his effervescent knowledge and widespread awareness of all the sources. It's absolutely amazing. It's just incredible even. So after those two books were there, and the second book was translated into Hebrew, 1992, Mavol, the Mishneh Torah, the Rambam, and now we have Rabbi Horowitz's anthology of Rabbi Tversky's academics works. He's now here to stay. When Rabbi Tversky passed away, a major Sefer Zikaron was put out in his memory, where the greatest of scholars contributed. So Rabbi Tversky, for sure, has made his mark on Jewish studies for posterity. But I'd like to focus on the Torah side of the Tolna Rebbe. And to this end, so I say again, what you have I sent last night was the article that appeared in the Torah Tidbits, and you're all welcome to read it at your free time, your leisure. But I have the one page of sources. And the one page of sources is taken out of the book, Torah of the Mind, Torah of the Heart, and dealing with Parshat Shkalim. This coming Shabbat, as you know, we read Parshat Shkalim. And the first question that Rabbi Tversky raises is the connection between Parshat Shkalim and Purim. Now, on the surface, there's no connection. There's no connection. Because the purpose of the annual announcement that was done in days of Beit HaMikdash, that you are to bring forth your half shekel coin, which began on Rosh Chodesh Adar. The purpose was that come Rosh Chodesh Nisan, 2 weeks before Pesach, the monies collected will now go for the purchase of the corporate activities of Beit HaMikdash, the animals, the grain, the oils, whatever Beit HaMikdash required. So it had to come from funds. And every year, come Rosh Chodesh Nisan, the funds had to come from fresh money, freshly collected money. And they gave Am Yisrael a month's time to come up with the half shekel. And the half shekel was a uniform amount, Ha'ashir lo yabeh v'hadal lo yam'it mimachzit ha'shakel. And this was done so that everyone should understand that he doesn't have a greater share in Beit HaMikdash activity than the next. Whether you're wealthy, whether you're poverty stricken, whatever it may be, everybody's giving the identical amount, and there's a great idea of unity and equality built into the fabric of this mitzvah. So it has nothing to do with Purim. Yet, in the source number one, our Chachamim tell us that there is something here of a Purim message. In Megillat Esther, in the Masechet Megillat, Daf Yud Gimel, quoting from Megillat Esther, in source number one, it reads, Im al ha-melech tov yikatev le'abdam, v'aseret alafim kikar kesef, eshkol al yedei osei hamlacha. It's interesting, the print left out actually the key word of this drasha. Haman is telling the king, and is willing to pay 10,000 pieces of silver, aseret alafim kikar kesef, eshkol. Eshkol comes from the word to weigh out. Mishkal means to weigh something, a scale, to weigh it out. And that's how monies were given. They were weighed. And therefore, the amount of the coin in the Torah became known as a shekel, because it's a weight. And hence, the Torah, the Megillah says, the Mar Haman is offering 10,000 shekel, eshkol al yedei osem lacha, to pay out. But Chazal picked up on the word eshkol, which the root is shekel, and said as follows, Amar Reish Lakish, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said as follows, Galui v'yadua lefnei mi she'amar v'haya ha'olam. It was known to the one who said, and there shall be a world, which in our words are the Creator. It was known to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Creator, she'atid Haman lishkol shkalim ha'Yisrael, that Haman is willing to cough up shkalim to eradicate Am Yisrael. He's willing to pay for this great schut of the destroying Am Yisrael. Lefikach hikdim shiklehem lishkalav. So what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is he preempts. It's what we call lakdim trufa lemakah, to have the remedy before the makah, the illness. The remedy is already on the shelf. HaKadosh Baruch Hu preempts Haman and gives us a mitzvah before Purim to give shkalim, to negate and neutralize the effect of the shkalim that Haman is going to pay out. And this is what the Gemara says, Lafikach higdim shiklehem lishkalav, v'haynu ditran, and that's what it says in the Mishnah, be'echad be'adar, on the first of Adar, Rosh Chodesh, mashmi'in al ha-shkalim v'al ha-kelayim. So kelayim we're not dealing with now, but shkalim. So echad be'adar is 2 weeks before Purim, and here the halakha is that 2 weeks before Purim, we begin giving the machzit ha-shekel. What does that have to do with Purim? Nothing. But it acts as a type of preventive measure, as a guarantee that whatever Haman had in mind, it's not going to, he will not succeed. Am Yisrael will not be destroyed. And what's interesting is that from here you see something very interesting. I remember once in conversation with the Rav, and I mentioned this tangentially in my book, that the Rav once told me that we were talking about the question of Miu Yehudi, who is a Jew? And this was a more serious question of what went on in Israel since 1950 with the first piece of legislation in the Knesset of guaranteeing every Jew the right to return and becoming a citizen immediately. So, you know, you don't have to wait 5 years to become naturalized if you're Jewish. The only question is, who is a Jew? And this became a very, very big issue since 1950 until this very day. The law reads that someone who's born from a Jewish mother and someone who converts. But the word converts, one key word is left out, and that is converts according to halakha, because there are many who convert. You have Reform conversion, Conservative conversion, Orthodox conversion. Exactly whose conversion are we talking about? If somebody is converted by a Reform rabbi, the halakha is still going to view that person as non-Jewish with all its ramifications for the yichus, the progeny, the idea of who the family is, and so on. It's not going to be a simple matter. So the question is, miyu Yehudi? So I remember the discussing once this issue with the Rav of miyu Yehudi. So he told me in a humoristic way. He said, "You want to know who miyu Yehudi? Who's a Jew? You don't even need Shulchan Aruch. Go to your local anti-Semite and he'll tell you exactly who is a Jew. And lechumra, the idea of miu yudi being the one who the anti-Semite wants to get rid of. And in the case of Haman, who did he want to get rid of? Every single Jew. Lashmid, laharog, ul'abed, et kol hayudim, mina'ar va'ad zaken, taf v'nashim, b'yom echad. He wanted to get rid of every single Jew, the entire Jewish nation. And what's interesting, the Chachamim say that the antidote was the mitzvah of giving shkalim, because the mitzvah of shkalim is a mitzvah that's not an individual mitzvah. It's a mitzvah of all of Klal Yisrael. The Talmud Yerushalmi says on the Pasuk, Ze yitinu kol over al apkudim, this is what you should be giving when you're donating the machzit ha-shekel. The word Ze is the gematria, the numerical equivalent of 12, and it means 12 tribes have to give. Now, what exactly were Chachamim saying? 12 tribes have to keep the mitzvot. So why have an allusion to the word Ze equals 12? The point is that this is a mitzvah that everybody has to be a participant. It's the corporate nature of Klal Yisrael, because Beit HaMikdash is not a private institution. It's a corporate institution. And that's why everyone had to be equal. And hence it was this mitzvah of a corporate nature that would be able to neutralize and negate that which Haman wanted to do, and that is to annihilate the entire Jewish nation. Lashmid la'arog u'labed et kol hayudim. So this is one connection clearly to Purim. But then the Rav Tversky points out, and this was classic, he now cites Hasidic masters. And we are familiar with Rav Shlomo Alevi Alkevatz. Shlomo Alevi Alkevatz is the author of the Lecha Dodi. And you see his name in the acrostic of Shlomo v'Zachor, Likrat Shabbat, Mikdash Melech, Hit Na'ari, that Shlomo, and Halevi, Hit Orvi, V'Hayu, Limshisa, V'Yamin Usmol, and so on. Halevi, you have it there. That's classic, Tzfat, 16th century. He's part of that orbit of the Kabbalists of Tzfat in the 16th century. So he writes a book called Sefer Manot Levi. Sefer Manot Levi, and there, he quotes the following, and I have this on the page. I'm going to read it. I know not everybody has the page, but from the Pasuk that Am Yisrael is accused before Achashverosh by Haman as being Mifuzar Umforad Ben Amim. They're spread out amongst the whole nation. Says the Rav Shlomo Halevi Alkevatz, Ki Pirudei Bnei Yisrael Zemizeh Al Yedei Sinat Chinam Rav Hu. That, you know why Am Yisrael are spread out? When there is hatred, we would say irrational hatred, sinat chinam, irrational hatred amongst ourselves. We don't even know why we don't like the next guy. And if that's great amongst the people, then the nation is spread out and there is no unity within the people. The flip side, or the rectification, or the tikkun, using Kabbalistic language, is the pasuk mishloach manot ish lereyu, the idea of giving mishloach manot on Purim. So the Rav Shlomo Levi Alkevatz says mishloach manot ish lereyu kemo shehaya inyanam ki ish echad lehikahel kol echad im chaviro. What Esther points out to Mordechai as the drama is unfolding, lech kenos et kol hayudim hanimtzim mishushan. Get everybody together, v'tzumu alai, and fast, v'al tochlu v'al teshtu shlosh yamim v'layla v'yom. And if you have everybody organized together in a massive effort of tefillah, then I'll feel that I have the backing of all of Klal Yisrael, and I'm willing to take the risk to go into the chambers of Achashverosh. That's the way the psukim read. And I'll say parenthetically that the Rav pointed out once that it says, v'al tochlu v'al teshtu. Don't eat and don't drink. So why does it say v'tzumu alai and fast? We know that fasting is don't eat and don't drink. So it seems to be superfluous. So the Rav said that in biblical Hebrew, there are two different words for fasting. One is called ta'anit, We call it ta'anit, and that comes from the word inui, affliction, from Yom Kippur, where there it says, ta'anu et nafshotechem, which is the phrase that you shall fast, and affliction. And the other is called tzom. That's also found in Tanakh. Tzom comes from the word braided. You know, a woman makes a tzama, a braid, from a hair. So what happens when you take wild hair and you braid it? You make it into a tzama. What happens when Am Yisrael fasts, as Esther was calling upon Am Yisrael to fast? They join together. V'tzumu alai, and let us all join together by not eating and not fasting. V'al tachlu v'al tishtu. So that's what the tzom is. The tzom is not the fact that you're not eating and not drinking, but more so it's the kinoset kol ha'yudim, that you're getting everybody together. And Rav Tversky then quotes a second source that the same Rav Shlomo Lalkavatz is quoted by another Kabbalist, a contemporary Kabbalist, Rav Moshe Alshich. And if I'm not mistaken, the previous head of the police department may have been a direct descendant of the Alshich. And here he says that why was it a half a shekel? Why didn't God say everybody should give a shekel? Why the business of a half a shekel? So he says that I heard from the Chacham Rav Shlomo ben Alkavatz, Shehu lehorot et bnei Yisrael yachas achdutatam. It comes to teach us the relationship of unity. Bal ya'ale alev ish mehem shehu nifrad mechaviro. No one should give a moment's thought that he's separate and from another Jew. Kiim ki'ilu kol echad chetzi. Everyone is like a half. And by connecting it, you connect to the other half. You connect to another Jewish person. Whole Am Yisrael becomes wholesome. Naseh Shalem. And that's why it was given to us in the form of Machzit HaShekel. And Rav Tversky points out that in two responsa of the Chatam Sofer. Chatam Sofer is 19th century halachist, Rav Moshe Sofer from Presburg, and he writes halacha, but sometimes in the course of his writing of halacha, he gravitates to some type of agadic explanation. And in two occasions, he mentions, this is why we have Mishloach Manot, because it comes to counteract the Mefuzar Umforad Bamachloket. And he quotes the Sefer Manot HaLevi of Shlomo Levi Alkavatz. And then in another responsum, he says, and this is the reason why we have Machzit HaShekel, half of coin, the Horot Shetzchim Litchaber B'maaseyem, and from two become one. He reiterates in the name of the Shlomo Levi Alkavatz. What's interesting, the reason that I believe the Talmud Rebbe brought these citations from the Chatam Sofer, because you may think that Shlomo Levi Alkavatz, he made his mark in the Siddur for Friday night, in Lechad Odi. How many people have ever heard of him in terms of explanations and halachic explanations? Okay, so if you're Rabbi Tversky and you're familiar with all the Hasidic literature, so you're familiar with it. I must admit that I was not familiar with Rav Shlomo Levi Alkavatz's Hasidic works, yet the Chatam Sofer, that's mainstream halacha. Mainstream halacha. Many, many, many poskim till this very day will base their halachic rulings on statements of the Chatam Sofer. And if these two ideas in Rav Shlomo Levi Alkavatz's writings make it, they surface in the responsa literature of the Chatam Sofer, that means they enjoy great credibility in the world of Torah. And Rabbi Tversky took the pains to publicize it on a particular Sudah Shlishit. And so too, he takes off on a discussion of Purim, and this may have been on a Shabbat that was related, either close to Purim, perhaps it was like this year, I don't even know, there's no date on it, but just as this year, Purim is on Friday and Shabbat, in Yud Dalet, the 14th of Adar is Friday, and Tevav is on Shabbat, and it's very likely that he spoke about it on Shabbat. And you know that here in Yerushalayim, for those who observe Purim on the 15th. So this year we will read the Megillah on Friday, on the 14th, just like our Tel Aviv brethren. And we will also give Matanot Levyonim on the 14th, like our Tel Aviv brethren. But on Shabbat, we will say Al Anisim in the davening. We will also have a special Maftir and Haftarah reading. But the meal, the Sudat Purim, is going to be postponed till Sunday with the Mishloach Manot. So it's certainly appropriate on the 15th of Adar on Shabbat to talk about Mishloach Manot that's still relevant for Yerushalmi people the next day. And what Rav Tversky does here with this is he cites a Gemara, a famous Gemara, Masevet Shabbat, Daf Pechet, with regard to Matan Torah. We just read about Matan Torah yesterday, and the concluding parasha is going to be this coming Shabbat, the very tail end of Parshat Mishpatim, where you hear the Na'aseh V'Nishma declaration. That's not in Yitro, it's in Parshat Mishpatim. And the Gemara cites the pasuk that we read just yesterday, Vayityatzvu B'Tachtit Ahar, that Am Yisrael were on the, as if on the foot of the mountain. So just before I just overlooked something, just going back to the last thought about gathering, Rabbi Tversky added something, a very interesting original idea that he snuffs out of a radak, but he puts it very nicely. In order to make the point that the giving of the Machtzis HaShekel is a unifying experience, so the Mishnah says, and source number five, Be'echad Ba'adar Mashmi'in Al HaShkalim, which means it was announced. That's the translation, that's the understanding. Beit Din made an announcement. Yet Rav Tversky cites a Pasuk in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tedvav, Pasuk Dalid, Vayishama Shaul Et Ha'am, Vayifkadem Vatla'im Mataim Elef Ragli, Vaseret Alafim Et Ish Yehuda. What does Vayishama mean? So Radak says, Kimo Vayeh. It means that they were gathered together. And Radak continues and says, the Chain B'Mishnah, as it appears in the Mishnah, the Echad B'Adar Mashmi'in Al Hashkalim. So there he says, Pirush Machrizim. We announce something. But the Retorsky fine-tuned this, and he says, Mashmi'in means the announcement for the purpose of uniting and gathering. And that's how he understood by Yeshama Shaul et Ha'am, and that's how he now is reading into the Mishnah, Be'echad Be'adar Mashmi'in Al Hashkalim. We are gathering everybody together through the mitzvah of the Machzit HaShekel. So now I get back to Har Sinai. So Am Yisrael stood at the footsteps of the mountain by Yitzu Tachtit Ahar, and our Chachamim say that what happened here was as if to say HaKadosh Baruch Hu lifted the mountain on top of Am Yisrael, and kafa aleim har kigiyeh, to put a mountain on top of them like a barrel, and basically said, all right, what's the deal? You accept the Torah? Wonderful. If not, the barrel is going to come right down on your head and your burial site will be right here. So it's already been questioned, if this is the case, where's the free will? Where's the free will? Am Yisrael is being lauded that they accepted the Torah by free will, Naseh v'Nishma. And here comes along an idea that it wasn't exactly free will. We were arm twisted. I mean, you know, the gun was loaded and pointed to our head, and we were asked, all right, no, do you want the Torah? You don't want the Torah? If you don't, fine, it's all up to you. But if you don't want, I'm pulling the trigger. And basically, that's what the Chazal was saying. So Gemara then comes up and says that there was a rededication to Kabbalat Torah, to the acceptance of Torah, at the time of Purim, where it says in chapter 9 of the Megillah, Kimu v'kiblu ayudim, Chachamim said, Kimu mashe kiblu kvar. They accepted what they took upon themselves once upon a time ago. So actually, there was a rededication, and this was completely voluntary on their part. And what their basic thing is that even the first time around, it was voluntary. It wasn't something that was under duress. Matter of fact, I think it was the Vilna Gaon who pointed out that the Medrash that says, Kafa aleim har kigigit, that God put his barrel over their head in the form of Mount Sinai, was said on a Pasuk after Am Yisrael already agreed to accept the Pasuk. And they said, Na'aseh, we will perform. So the basic agreement out of free will was accomplished. And now Kadosh Baruch Hu basically is saying, good thing you took that stand, because had you not taken that stand, this really would have been the end of Am Yisrael. We'd have to start all over again. But you were okay. You made the right decision. And on this pasuk, the Torah says in the source number 9, Vayichan Yisham Yisrael Neged Ahar, Am Yisrael stood singular. Well, every time we have an expression that Am Yisrael rested from any of their journeys, as you see it often enough in Parshat Mas'ei, Vayisu, Vayachanu, Vayisu, Vayachanu, Vayisu, Vayachanu. Vayachanu means they camped. Because you have 12 tribes and everybody's camping in their place, in their way, and so on. But when it came to Har Sinai, it says, yes, Vayachanu Sham, Vayachanu Bamidbar. They came and they camped in the desert. Vayichan Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, in the singular. Singular meaning that Am Yisrael collectively. And Rashi says, Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad. They were all in this together. There was a united stance right here at this point. And this having become the symbol of what Matan Torah was all about, is the symbol of what Purim is all about, of Kimu v'Kiblu. Again, once a time, they became a united front. And what's interesting also is a halachic discussion. How come for Mishloach Manot, we don't have a bracha? I mean, it's a bracha, it's a mitzvah we do once a year. So why don't you make a bracha? Asher kitchano b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu al Mishloach Manot, al Mishloach Manot ish l'reyeyu. I mean, it's a rabbinic mitzvah, but so is the reading of the Megillah, and there's a bracha. So why is there no bracha on the mitzvah of Mishloach Manot? The same question was raised about Kibbur Ava'im, right? Every time the parent asks the child to take the garbage out, so before you take the garbage out, you have to say, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Ha'olam Asher Yitzanu Zav Zivanu al Kibbur Ava'im. But we don't have such a bracha. And we don't have a bracha for tzedakah either. There are many mitzvot where Chachamim did not make a bracha. And the answer is, Chachamim never made a bracha on a mitzvah that does not have a particular time framework, but it's everlasting. It's 24/7, as we say. There's no such time framework where the mitzvah is not binding. So the mitzvah of believing in the existence of God, Adonai Hashem Elokecha, that we read yesterday in the 10th commandments, does not carry a bracha. Because you're always obligated in Enoche Hashem Elokecha. And you're always obligated in Ahavat Hashem, the love of God. And you're always obligated in Et Hashem Elokecha Tira, having awe for Kadosh Baruch Hu. And you're always obligated in Kibbur Ava'im. There's no such thing that you're obligated in Kibbur Ava'im on Mother's Day and on Father's Day. I remember the yeshiva that I went to in the United States, the teachers were very against Mother's Day and Father's Day, as if once a year you have a mitzvah of Kibbur Av and Kibbur Aim. Kibbur Ava'im is every day, 24/7, Kibbur Ava'im, Shabbos, Yom Tov, Yom Kippur, Tuesday afternoon, whatever it might be. So what's this Mother's Day, Father's Day? Of course, we understood that it was the card company that it wanted to make money. So and the flowers. So fine. So it was Mother's Day and Father's Day. So here in Israel, you know, we have to be copycats. So we also have a Yom Ha'im, right? And, if they do it in America, so they have to do it here. But you ever notice we don't have Father's Day here? There's no Yom Ha'av. You know why? Because we have Chodesh Av. We don't need a Yom Av already. But the idea of a mitzvah that does not have a time framework does not necessitate a bracha. So you might think, one second, the Megillah has a bracha because it has a time framework, either the 14th or 15th of Adar, but it's a time framework. And the Hanukkah has a time framework, the 25th of Kislev for 8 nights, successive nights, time framework. So Mishloach Manot, do you give Mishloach Manot in the month of Shvat or the month of Kislev? You don't do that. So it's bound to the framework of a time framework. So why shouldn't there be a mitzvah, a bracha that goes along with it? So the Sri Deish, who was Bichir Yaakov Weinberg, Zichron Lavrocha, he was the last reigning Rosh Hashiva in the Hildesheimer Rabbinic Seminar, a seminary in Berlin before World War II, unfortunately suffered in the Shoah, but survived. And he makes it to Montreux as a Rosh Hashiva in Schweiz. I'll just say parenthetically, he was offered in 1954 to come in Aliyah and to serve at the newly formed Bar Ilan University as a Rosh Hashiva of a proposed yeshiva program that was going to happen, which never did. But he was offered that task, that position. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg was also a person who very much reflected the type of person of Rabbi Tversky. He was a Gaon, a great Talmud Chacham and Posek, and he was a scholar in every sense of the word in Jewish studies, very much so, in that kind of a spirit, and was able to synthesize those two modes of religious, of Jewish existence. So in the Sri Deish, in one of his tshuvot, he says, he quotes the Chatam Sofer, and it deals with the question, how come we don't have a bracha, v'tzivanu ha-mishloch manot? And he says, the Chatam Sofer says something remarkable. He says, you think giving mishloch manot should be because some halachic authority is coercing you to do it? You should be doing it on your own. You should understand that if you're observing Purim and there's a neighbor who perhaps doesn't have food for his Purim Suda, you should be doing that chesed on your own without the necessity of a mitzvah. Yes, it's a mitzvah because some of us don't understand that we should be doing things on our own. But because in the pristine mode of chesed, it should be coming from yourself, from your inner self, therefore the motivating factor is not vitzivanu, it's not the command, but you yourself should be doing it. And furthermore, the idea of helping and giving is not a Purim concern. It's 24/7 throughout the year. True enough that on Purim, it's given a certain structure and formality to it. But you think that once a year, you're supposed to share with what you have with your neighbors? You should be doing it all the time. And people should be sharing with each other all the time. I bemoan the fact that when I look at the Mishloach Manot that's given today, it's packaged with packaged foods, with a lot of chazarai, a lot of, you know, bisli and bamba and wafers and so on. And people are very careful, you know, that has all kinds of ashgachot that make sure all the neighbors are going to eat it. But God forbid not to put on the plate something that was baked in your kitchen. It's just not done today in most circles. I can tell you that in some circles, people have gone back to it. Because the original idea of Mishloach Manot is that I should give two items from my menu of the Purim Suda to the neighbor, and the neighbor should give two items from his or her menu to the next neighbor, so that in theory, everyone was eating from everyone. That's called Lech Kinos et Kol HaYudim. Get everybody together on the same meal. So you can't stretch the table and put all of Klal Yisrael on one table in your dining room, but you can symbolically share your menu with the neighbors and the neighbors with their neighbors and so on, so that ultimately everybody is eating from everybody in a sense. And today, because people are so nervous about the kashrus of your kitchen and your kitchen and which hashkocha do you use and are you careful of this chumra and that chumra and that chumra, nobody eats from anybody, which is a terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing that this is what we've degenerated, literally degenerated. I remember when I was in visiting once Melbourne, Australia. So I made reference to the fact that we had in our neighborhood in Ramot, it was a big blizzard. And so once in a while, Shalim has a big blizzard and really the roads were all closed and everything. And a boy in our neighborhood was supposed to get married that night in Ramat Rachel. There was nowhere anybody was able to get to Ramat Rachel. So you figure, all right, they're going to have to postpone the wedding. But we counseled the chosin and the kala, you know what, we'll make the wedding here in Shul by us and bring the immediate family who live in the neighborhood. And we'll ask some neighbors to come also to the Shul and make sameach, as they say. And I remember 6 hours before the wedding at 2 p.m., so a bunch of women got together in Shul and they split up the tasks. And They brought the Shabbos platter to the Ezrat Hashem, and they brought whatever they had from the refrigerator, leftovers from Shabbat. And there was tremendous amount of food for everybody, and a lot of simcha, and a lot of everything. There were some boys put up a band, and somebody was a photographer, and then we made a collar chair. We did everything. The collar was very nervous about such a wedding, and at the end, she didn't have any regrets. It was the way, I don't think Prince Charles had such a wedding. It was such a great wedding, really a phenomenal chasana. It was written up afterwards in the Post and other places. The idea of eating from everybody. Somebody asked me in Melbourne, you mean in your shul people eat from everybody? I said, yeah, in my shul people eat from everybody. Because he said that the person told me that the rabbi doesn't allow it because you don't want to insult anybody who maybe you can't eat from and so on. I'm not saying the rabbi's wrong. The rabbi might be 100% right in his local situation. But as they say, la'ani ganu. Look where we're at, that we can't do this. The ideal is that we can eat from everybody. And the halacha is that if somebody has a cheskat kashrut, it's kosher. And you don't have to have a mashgiach in your kitchen because eid echad ne'eman be'isurin. If a person, man or woman, is legitimately there to testify that it's kosher. So 100%, and that's all you need. You need somebody who knows what he or she is doing. And then it becomes kosher. So you have this discussion about the birkata mitzvah as well. And mishloach manot is now being expanded to a concept that has to do with the inner feeling of helping others, not only on Purim, but Purim becomes a type of springboard for our general behavior throughout the year, which, by the way, is the same thing that happens on Pesach. There are many things that we have on Leil HaSeder, which, as the Rav used to point out, it was a model lesson, as we used to call it in school. It's a model lesson, and the model lesson means the things that we have, elements that we have in the Seder, we're supposed to take with us after Pesach, and not just say, see you next year, the Shana Abba, you know, B'nei Chorin, we'll see you next year. But it should be very much so taken into consideration that there's continuation. So too with Yom Kippur, that the fact is we break our fast Yom Kippur, but there's something about the spirit of Yom Kippur is supposed to continue. And that's generally what the concept of Kiddushah is all about, sanctity. Kiddushah Tayom indeed comes to an end, but it doesn't come to a drastic end, a sharp end at sundown. We pull it to at least Tzeta Kochavim. And even Tzeta Kochavim, we pull it to a later view of Tzeta Kochavim. And there's some people who even take it even later. And in Hasidic circles, that they wouldn't make Avdolah until 11 p.m. and just fight off the fact that Shabbat is ending. Literally fight off the fact and not join the minyan that starts in shul 15 minutes before the shul minyan so that they can finish early. The idea of marichim, to extending Shabbat and extending Kedusha, is really the thrust of what many of these mitzvot are all about. And this is one of the great messages of Rabbi Twersky as the Polner Rebbe. And he succeeded very much so in inculcating this to his kehillah, his thriving kehillah in Boston. And now hopefully with the dissemination of much of his Torah as the Polner Rebbe, his great thoughts are going to make it to Klal Yisrael as well. Thank you.